Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Welcome to another exciting and informative edition of Atlanta Business Radio. Stone Payton and producer Blake here with you this morning. Lee Cantor is out. He's down in South Florida taking care of some family business. Blake, you've been a busy guy. You're wrapping up an audiobook project, right?
Yes, I am. It's been a very exciting process. My first audiobook I've ever produced. It was a book by Pete Canalicchio, and I highly suggest you would go check it out once it's out. It's called Expand, Grow, Thrive. So once it's out, go join up on Audible. It's going to be a great book.
So is this a one and done for you? Are you going to do more of these audiobook projects, or are you glad for the experience and thank you very much? No thanks.
No, I actually enjoyed this process a lot. I look forward to doing it more. Hopefully I'll be able to do it a lot more often. Maybe this will bring in more clients once they hear it. I'm not sure. I hope the future brings a lot of good things.
Well, I'm sure it will. I know this. I didn't know whether we would ever intentionally get in the audio book recording business, but one thing we are going to start putting some more energy and effort into is there are a lot of practitioners out there who have a great deal of thought leadership, sort of almost entrapped, right, in their mind. Yeah. And so we do have this service that we're going to be spending more energy on called First Draft. And we're going to help them craft some prompts so that one or more of our certified Business Radio X facilitators, host, can share those prompts and sort of draw enough information out of them to sort of get like a first draft of a book together, maybe transcribe it, and then we'll have to get somebody smarter than us to help them, you know, like a good writer or something or editor to get it. But I think that service has some promise too.
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful idea, and I think that'll also bring other ideas of maybe getting it as an audiobook and as well, and getting that right out the box instead of writing the book and then thinking, oh, I want to do an audiobook after this, so let's do that now.
And it ought to keep you and I both from having to get real jobs.
Well,
what do you think about that?
That would be a good idea, but I feel like this is a real cool job. So
it is. It's a lot of fun. Today's going to be no exception. A little bit later in the broadcast, we're going to get a chance to hear from Normani Ricks, and looking forward to catching up with her. But first up on Atlanta Business Radio this morning, please join me in welcoming back to the Business Radio X microphone, a guy who wants to talk about shedding the hustle, setting work-life boundaries, and redefining success. He's got a new book out called The Un-American Dream, Mr. Carlos Hidalgo. Good morning, sir.
Hey, good morning, Stone. So good to be back.
Well, we are delighted to have you. Man, what prompted you to go to all the energy and effort that I know that it takes to craft a book, man?
Yeah, it's really, the book is a lot of my story and also the story of so many others. So I had been CEO for 12 years of an agency here in Atlanta, and that agency is still functioning and doing well from all accounts.
Maybe even better. No, I'm kidding.
Well, you never know, right? Anytime there's a change in leadership, there's great opportunity. But for me, I had spent so much of my time as an entrepreneur and a business owner investing in my business. And it really became an obsession of mine. And we only have 168 hours each week in which we can do things. And so what I found was I came to a breaking point, because while I was putting so much into my business, I was neglecting my relationships, primarily my relationship with my wife, my relationship with my children. And I came to, as I talk about in the book, I hit rock bottom, where I was on the footstep of a divorce, and estranged from my kids, and that they didn't really know me and I didn't know them, because for so long all I had done is build the business. And so when I decided to leave that agency, I was surprised by the number of individuals who reached out to me and said, well, how did you do this? What steps did you take? Because I'm in the same place. And so it kind of sparked something in me to say, we as entrepreneurs and business owners and even executives, we strive so hard to reach that American dream, but we've really perverted it. It's become quite un-American. And you read and you see the things of the hustle culture today of, you know, work, 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 work. Well, that's not what we were designed for. So through a lot of introspection, a lot of work on myself and my relationships, that's the genesis of the book. It's really a call to say, how can we define success differently and live a wholehearted life?
So was there a definitive wake-up call, a crystallizing moment that caused you to have that aha moment, or was it a slower build that got you to this point?
Well, some of the choices were definitely a slower build. I didn't wake up one day and say, I'm just going to put all my heart, soul, and energy into a business at the risk of everything else. Really, the wake-up call was, I'm not going to stay married, and I have to make a choice. I can either pursue business growth, or I can pursue a relationship and figure this out. So leaving that agency was a 10-month process, because what I tried to do is, within that context, make some changes. And then I realized in October of 2016 that was a chapter of my life I literally had to put behind me and make that decision to do so. And once I did, it was a risk. I didn't have any big plan, big life savings, no big buyout. But once I made that decision and made it known to my partners, it was like this huge burden was just lifted off my shoulders.
Now, I'm operating under the impression that you did not make the decision to immediately begin journaling that experience for the benefit of mankind, or did you have that much forethought?
You know, and at the end, right around that time, I did have a thought of,
oh wow,
the phrase, the un-American dream, came into my head.
Really?
And I shared it with a friend, and he said, man, that just sounds like an angry book. And I actually write about that in the introduction. And had I written at that time in the space that I was at, it would have been an angry book. So I'm glad I waited. I'm mm-hmm. glad that I waited to do some work on myself and to have some reflection, because I don't believe in any way, shape, or form it's an angry book. It's really a call and an invitation to individuals like me to say, hey, let's step off this treadmill. We should and still should work hard, but we don't have to hustle. We don't have to make our business and our careers the center of all things, because that's not what we're wired for as human beings. We're really wired for meaningful, deep relationship first and foremost. And so if we're putting our heart and soul into that and then setting boundaries to get the best out of our work, we really can live wholehearted, joyful lives.
I'd like to unpack that a little bit, because as an entrepreneur, I mean, I'm terminally unemployable. I've been an entrepreneur almost my entire life. My mind is consumed virtually 24/7 with the business. And mm-hmm. I find a great deal of joy in a bunch of it. And I'm at a really good place right now. And I really do jump out of bed most mornings wanting to come do something and tweak something and turn a dial or hit a lever with this business. But I probably, like so many people, I think I really do identify very heavily. My identity is so wrapped up in my mm-hmm. work.
Yeah. And I was the same way. My identity and my worth were all tied to my work and the performance of the agency and who I was and the first book that I wrote and did people recognize me. And what I really came to find is that my identity and worth is simply because I have a spark of the divine, stealing from Kelly Flanagan, who wrote a phenomenal book that really impacted me. And so that is where we find our identity. And I find that it's especially true for men. We do have an opportunity more so to put our identity and our worth into our work. And I don't know why that is. I'm not a psychologist. But what I was able to do was say, I'm no more worthy, or my identity isn't any greater or less, if I'm leading an agency to two Inc. 5000 awards or sweeping floors for a living. It doesn't, that doesn't matter. Status and title and bank account don't define who I am.
All right. So what does matter then in your experience, or you've now come to believe that there are some other things that matter?
Yeah. I mean, for me right now, what matters first and foremost are my relationships. And so my relationship first and foremost with God, and then my relationship with my wife and my kids, those things matter to me most. But at the same time, I've defined boundaries that allow me to give the best of myself to those. And so I have a relationship boundary and some things that I've put into my life to guard the values that I have in terms of my relationship. At the same time, I have a boundary that allows me to give the best of myself to my work. And so I work really hard. We have a group of clients that we work with, and they get the best of me. My creativity is better. My thinking is better. But there also is a time during the day where I shut it down. I shut it off, because now it's time for me to give to those relationships. And so it's things like, I don't work past a certain time in the day. I don't work before a certain time during the day. I don't work on weekends anymore. So that means I'm not taking calls. I'm not checking emails. I'm not catching up on documentation. And now that I've put some of that structure in place and those boundaries to guard the things I value, both relationship and work, I'm actually better at both than I've ever been before in my life, and I'm almost 50 years old.
Well, that has to feel very rewarding. This reminds me, and some of you in the listening audience are going to be old enough to know what I'm talking about, but back in the day, I would listen to cassette tapes, and I was a commission-based salesperson, so again, really an entrepreneur even back then.
Right.
And Zig Ziglar did this bit about when you're at work, you're thinking about family. When you're with your family, you're thinking about work. And he, of course, I can't do it justice, but the punchline was, and you ain't never nowhere.
Yeah. You know?
But that can happen to us, right? We're not really fully wherever we are because we're not setting these boundaries.
Well, and I think we've deluded ourselves to say that we can multitask. And really, for me, the punch in the face, if you want brutal honesty, go to your kids.
But that's good advice, isn't it, Norman?
In 2016 was the first time, and I say this almost embarrassingly, that first time ever, I never took my laptop on a vacation.
Ah.
And so my daughter, who was 17 at the time, about day 2, day 3 of the vacation, said, "Dad, I'm really glad you didn't bring your laptop." And I said, "Well, I appreciate that." I said, "But I always worked before you guys got up." And she said, "Yeah, but then you spent the rest of the day thinking about what you worked on."
Oh, wow.
And what she was really communicating was, you were here physically, but you were never present. You were never available. Your mind was elsewhere. And she was 100% right. And so even now, she was on she's now 20. She was on summer vacation with us this year. And she looked at me and said, "I'm really digging this work-life boundary thing you've got going on." She's like, "It's been so much fun hanging out with you." Because I I had to plan. I had to make sure that everybody knew I was going to be gone, that I wasn't going to be working. But when I got back, it was all still there and the world was still spinning on its axis. And I was truly able to put all of me into my vacation, into my family, and I was present and I was available. And it just showed. And I wasn't fishing for that compliment, but my daughter sensed it. And so did my other kids who are with us.
Now, can you really turn all of this on a dime, or do you have to sort of ease into it, or do you recommend easing into it as opposed to like cold turkey?
Yeah, I call it a practice, because I had somebody ask me the other day, "How did you arrive at this?" And I said, "Let me be really clear. I haven't arrived at anything, because old habits die hard." And like you, I think most entrepreneurs that I encounter and executives, we really love what we do for a living.
Yeah.
And so it is hard to just say, "I'm going to turn that off." So I do call it a practice. And what I first did is I defined what are the things that I value. So my relationship, my work product to my clients, I value my personal health, spiritually, mentally, emotionally, and physically. So I put boundaries around those. And then I invite people that are close to me. So I talk about doing it in community. And the number one member of that community is my wife, where I've invited her and we talk about these boundaries. So not long ago, twice, 2 days in a row at about 8 o'clock, I picked up my phone and I'm checking email. And she finally day 2 said, what's going on here? Like, this isn't the boundary that we've talked about. And she was right. So I kind of regressed a little bit. But if I'm not doing it in community and asking people to work with me, and that's why I call it a practice, because I'm talking about the stuff, I write about it, and here I am at 8 o'clock at night going outside my boundary because for some reason I feel this need to check my email. It's absurd because nothing was going to get done at 8 o'clock at night.
It's like an addiction, right? It's just it's such habit.
Well, and it's so easy for us to pull our phones out. So what I've started doing is once I got pulled back into that boundary, I put my phone away. I've turned off all the notifications. And I take off my wearable and I enjoy my evening with my family and with my wife. And so we have these routines that we have that we actually really enjoy, that we get to spend the time together. And it really helps cultivate that strong relationship, which allows me to do my work even better. When you have strong relationships that are healthy at home and in your community, you're going to be better at your work. And so again, my work product is off the charts, and I'm actually doing more in less time.
So the frame that I'm putting around this during this conversation is Stone's home. My wife and I both are professionals. She works from home. She works for IBM, and she is very involved in her work. I think she's instinctively better at this, turning it on and off,
right,
and boundaries than I know. I don't think. I know that she is. And I'm thinking, if I came home to her this afternoon, very committed to all of this, or I read the book tomorrow and then, you know, started on Wednesday or whatever, I think she'd be a little bit skeptical. And I think if I shared with her, I'm thinking you got to let them know that the rules are changing, or you're deciding right. to change the rules, and that you're asking for help and you're giving license to call you on the carpet.
Yes.
All these things are important. Otherwise, it's just like you went to a 3-day seminar and you came back all fired up and they expect you to flame out in a week, and he'll be back to normal in a week, right?
Well, and the actions do speak louder than the words. And that, when I remember in 2016, when I told my wife, I said, I'm not bringing my laptop. She kind of nodded and said, I will believe that when I see it. And she was fully justified in that response, because sure. I had talked about, oh, I'm only going to do a little work here. And before I knew it, you know, it's 10 a.m. and I'm still somewhere on vacation on my laptop working. Well, why am I doing that? That's absurd, because we all need rest. We're not, even machines need maintenance. Yet somehow, if you believe the hustle crowd and what they talk about, it's, you know, 24/7 we should be working and our mind should be on our businesses. Well, that means, again, you're going to follow the path I went down. You're not present and available for your relationships. And so there's a lot of rich people in the world. I have yet to encounter one who can buy time.
Well said.
We only have so much.
Another phrase that comes to mind. I've been blessed in a lot of ways, not the least of which is I've had a chance to work with a variety of mentors, and one by the name of Steve Brown. In teaching a leadership course, he suggested he actually emphasized that it was a leader's job to create an entity that could function in their absence.
Yes.
Like, if they got to have you 24/7, you haven't done your job. You haven't,
you know,
it sounds like you agree with that.
I do agree with that. And that was a conversation my wife and I had many times. And if I'm honest, and I talked about this in my TEDx that I gave last year, my ego got so wrapped up where it was, well, I had to be there. The show couldn't go on.
Yeah.
And the reality is, if I'm hiring the right people and empowering them and building a culture, I should be more than okay by saying, you don't need me there. Things can go handle it. Go do your job. Go do what we hired you to do. Now, if you need help, I'm here to help, but I don't need to insert myself. I don't need to be at places. And I did fall prey to that. And I actually have a chapter about that in the book called The Lies We Tell Ourselves. And one of the lies I told myself was I had to be there if things were going to go right. That's a lot narcissistic.
Well, it is. It's an emotional maturity issue, problem, thingy that right. we all need to work on if we're going to build an organization of any size and complexity and value. I definitely want to dive into the book a little bit, but I can't let this slide. You mentioned a TEDx talk.
Yes.
Say a little bit about that. Was it on this topic?
It was defining work-life boundaries, and it was to the TEDx Centennial Park women. So that was a little daunting for a man to get up in front of 450 women and talk about work-life boundaries. And it was really just a lot of what I had learned.
Right.
I kind of went through my journey and I said, look, full disclosure, I written a post on LinkedIn in 2015, I think it was, saying I'm completely unbalanced and I'm okay with that. And I look at that post now and I'm embarrassed. Now the hit of the TEDx was, if you go to that channel and you watch it, I followed up that post about 15, 16 months later, and the title was, I Was Wrong. And so when I showed that slide to the audience, for a man to admit to 450 women, hey, I was wrong, it got rave applause. So, but it was a fun engagement. I had a dear, dear friend who really went to bat for me and made sure I was there. So I had a great time doing it. It's a message that's near and dear to my heart. And I think as working professionals, it's something we have to do, because our phones make it so easy to stay connected. Yeah. And I believe most employers actually kind of bank on the fact that I'm going to get an extra 2 to 3 hours out of you. And so I, if there's any business leaders listening, I would really call on you to create a culture in your company that allows for those work-life balance, and you will get more production out of your employees.
And it's a little counterintuitive, I think, but I think I find myself agreeing with you, or at least wanting to believe what you're saying, and would really love the idea 6 months from now, a year from now, whatever, if I looked back on the Business Radio X network and I could really say that that kind of thing was true about the culture that we built, I got to go back and ask you, how does one prepare for a TEDx talk? Because what is it, like 18, 20 minutes? Not a big, you got to really know your, you got to get your stuff crystallized.
I was,
right?
I was given 15 minutes.
Wow.
I typically, I have the opportunity and the privilege to speak a lot.
Oh, okay. But so you're no stranger to the to
it's
the stage.
It's the first time I've memorized one of my speeches, so that was a little daunting. I practiced, so I wrote it all out, recited it. I would actually did an audio recording, and so I would listen to that while I ran. Probably not the most motivational running things to listen to, but I really just immersed myself in it and then practiced, and I'm so thankful for my wife who listened to it over and over and over. And the day before, there was a panel that I kind of practiced in front of. They gave me some feedback, which was really, really positive. They assigned me a coach that I worked with. Charles was fantastic. And so it came, and I was nervous. I was really, really nervous. And you know, it's a sensitive topic to me. It's a passionate topic. It's something I live through. So you really want to communicate the idea really clearly. And I gave it my best shot. Had a great time doing it. And it was fantastic. I'm so thankful I had the opportunity to do that.
So I bet it was great for the audience. And I know it feels good to feel like you've had even just a little bit of influence over a group of people like that. And I would suggest, or I'd like to kind of check this with you. Do you find when you prep and deliver a talk, or even in writing the book, that, yeah, it's great if it helps other people, but it also helps you sort of solidify, crystallize your own thinking on the topic, right?
It really does. The book in many ways was therapeutic to be able to get it. I've always been a better, I feel I'm a better writer than I am a speaker. So writing for me has always been a really good form of expression and an outlet for me. But really the book, and I talk about in the book, really all of us finding our one note, like what drives us and what is passionate. What are we passionate about? And for me, that one note is helping people. And it doesn't matter if I'm helping my neighbor move furniture or if I'm giving a talk. And so the whole purpose of the book is to help other entrepreneurs and business owners who may find themselves in a place of, I'm killing myself. I've told myself all these lies on why I'm doing this. But really, in my, you know, when I'm wide awake at 3 a.m. staring at the ceiling, I'm asking the question, what is this all for? And that's what the book is for, is to help people. And for me, if I didn't allow people to learn from my mistakes, I felt I was going to be selfish, and I couldn't let that happen.
So did you, once you got on this journey, did you discover your one note pretty quickly, or did you have to amble around a bit?
I ambled around a little bit. I did a lot of work. I did a lot of work on myself through the guidance of an amazing friend and good therapist. I was able to uncover and unpack and really go back to what really lights my fire, what gets me going, and what's going to get me, like yourself, what's going to get me out of bed every morning excited to go do what I do, and that is helping people. And so I believe we can live out our personal purpose if we identify that first and then say, how can we do that through our work? And I'm in a position where I get to help people through my writing. I do marketing consulting as well, so I get to help clients do that. And a lot of the relationships I've built, I'm even helping clients sort through people problems and career issues and things. So I feel really fortunate, you know, like Blake saying, it's a pretty cool job. I'm really right? fortunate, and I get to write about it. So I'm in an unbelievable position and so grateful for it.
So let's talk about writing a book. Did the book come easy, or did the first pieces of it come? What was that part like?
I don't know that I'm your typical author in terms, because just because of my ADD, it's all over the place. Some of the chapters came really easy. I had an amazing, amazing copy editor that I worked with, Katie, and can't say enough about her, and her thumbprints are all over that book. And she really pushed me to, I'd get a draft back and, you know, a note saying, you need to dig deeper here. So, But writing this particular one was easier than the first, because it really was my story and what I experienced and what I felt was a recap of a lot of conversations I had with colleagues and close friends who were in a similar situation. And so I knew I wanted to write about happiness and what does that mean? And it's ours for the taking, and then really the journey. And then there would be things along the way that would happen. I'd say, you know what? That makes a good chapter. So I never started with an outline. I just started to write.
Wow. And was there a chapter or two, though, that did kind of come together, I won't say clumsily, but harder than some of the others, that you just really, really took you a while to nail it?
Yeah, there's one, I believe it's chapter 4, is Are You Sacrificial or Are You Selfish? And that was by far the hardest chapter I wrote, because I had to go back and look at some of the things. Because as entrepreneurs and executives and leaders, we tend to think, hey, I'm sacrificing so much. I'm missing out on this, this, and this. Well, the reality is, if I haven't received or asked for the permission from those that I'm missing out on, I'm not sacrificing at all. They are. I'm just being selfish because I'm going after what I want.
Interesting.
And coming to that realization and having to write about it and tell some stories that were, for me, pretty emotional. And one of them I referenced in the TEDx where I got emotional on stage. Wasn't playing, but it happened.
That probably didn't hurt the applause either, right, Norman?
Yeah. Right.
A guy cries and he says he's wrong. Man.
Yeah, right?
Highest rated TEDx speaker ever, probably.
So, but that was one where I had to dig deep, and I didn't want to at first. I really wanted to hold back. And then, but probably for me, my favorite chapter in the book is the one my wife wrote. Because I felt really passionate that to every unhinged pursuit of business success, there's another person impacted. And for that, for me, I could have my kids write a chapter, but I wanted my wife to write her chapter and her perspective. And so her chapter is called A View from the Other Side, about what was it like to be married to a workaholic.
Oh, wow. All right. So context, backdrop, there's a whole consulting practice business behind up under this, right? So you're doing stuff
right
now, right?
I am, yes. So I started a new consultancy, which also got great laughs from the crowd at the TEDx. Started another business because just entrepreneur at heart.
Right.
But this one's different. So I have one business partner and I'm married to her. So we have a very clear line of duties on who does what, and it works really, really well. We love working together. We have really no quote unquote growth plan on target, you know, 5 years, we're going to be X million or this many employees. We don't want to hire employees, because what we've done is we've also really defined our purpose as a company. And part of that purpose is to give some of our profits away to nonprofits. So my wife is very involved with a nonprofit called Beauty for Ashes Uganda. So we give 5% of our profits to that organization that helps single moms and widows with education and long-term sustainability in a region in Uganda. So that's another thing, you know, that one note of helping people.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting to help people through our business. And so we're very purpose-driven versus revenue-driven.
Fantastic. So mission, purpose, focus for the consultancy. Who are you trying to help with that? Is it this kind of material?
Yeah, no. Well, I mean, some of it, yeah. So I have colleagues right now who are saying, hey, can you work with us to help us build a culture, or also help us engage, you know, just as an individual, as an executive, I need boundaries in my life. Can you help me establish those? So I'm doing that just as an outcome of the book. Our agency that we run, our consultancy, is really focused on business to business, B2B companies of all shapes and sizes. We work with Fortune 50 all the way down to startup, of how do you define an end-to-end customer experience and truly delight your customers at every stage.
Well, I mean, that is a topic. We had, you'll know this name, Horst Schulze with Ritz-Carlton.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I produced, I sat in Blake's chair. It was a client show. Jill Hynek runs a show called Customer Experience Radio out of here. And boy, I was just blown. In fact, I forgot to take pictures while I was back there. I was so engaged in just listening to this guy, because he's the guy behind Ladies and Gentlemen, serving Ladies and Gentlemen. And I was just enthralled, and it re-impressed upon me just how critical that is to, you know, to the enterprise. That was fantastic.
Oh, it is. And I think in B2B, they're just starting to realize, hey, we have a long customer journey. Our customers do. Customer experience starts long before anybody buys something.
Sure.
And so it's really, I think B2B brands are starting to wake up to it and realize that this is where we can maximize our revenue and really turn our customers into advocates for our brand.
So you're engaged in this work within reason, within limits.
Yes. Yes, that's
within
right.
the boundaries every day. That's the day to day work.
It's one of the many things that I do on a daily basis, and I really really enjoy it. And we have we're very thankful to work with some incredible clients who really want to drive change in their organizations.
Marvelous. All right, before we wrap, let's make sure that our listeners know how to get in touch with you or your wife or your team if they'd like to have a conversation mm-hmm. on that set of topics. So, you know, LinkedIn, email, whatever's appropriate to reach out and get with you.
Sure. They can go to our website, just www.theunamericandream.com. They can connect with me on Twitter at CA Hidalgo, and that's HIDALGO. Go to my LinkedIn profile, shoot me a note. I'm happy to do that. Or just email me at carlos@theunamericandream.com.
Fantastic. So that's also the best way to get their hands on the book is the unamericandream.com?
And they can also go right to Amazon, just type in The Un-American Dream and buy themselves a copy, both on Kindle, hard copy, and then we will be doing an audio version here shortly.
Hear that, Blake?
Yeah.
Well, it has been an absolute delight having
Likewise.
You on the show. Thanks so much for coming in, man, and sharing your story.
I appreciate you having me. It's always good to be back.
All right. Hey, stay with us. We're going to visit with one more guest.
Fantastic.
All right, Blake, you ready for the headliner?
Yep.
She's been very patient. She's listened. I really do feel like you got some value out of that last conversation, though, huh? I thought I saw your head nodding.
Yes, I got a lot of insight out of that.
All right. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio today, please join me in welcoming to the broadcast with Achieve Occupational Therapy Solutions owner and CEO, Miss Normani Ricks. So, yeah, what'd you learn out of that last segment?
Well, I learned the male perspective. I think about that a lot, work-life balance as a mom and as a business owner. So it's nice to know that I guess a man can step outside of his pride and kind of think about that as well and actually take enough time to write a book about it. So I appreciate that.
You're very welcome. It was not an easy process.
But we're all better for it, aren't we?
Right.
Even just having a conversation around it makes me feel more energetic around the whole set of topics. Mm-hmm. Mission, purpose of your outfit. What are you out there trying to do for folks?
So my business is called Achieve Occupational Therapy Solutions. I started working with children with vision disorders because my daughter was diagnosed with a vision disability. It's called convergence insufficiency, and she also has accommodative disorder. So it's a group of neurological vision disorders. So if you go and get an eye exam, you might test 20/20. So that's only testing nearsighted and farsighted, but it's not testing how the eyes work together. So nearsighted and farsighted and astigmatism are all the words that we're used to hearing when you go take a vision exam. And those are monocular vision disorders. But what I'm working with children on are binocular vision disorders.
So when you say working with children, that suggests to me that there are some things you can do to mitigate some of the effects of these conditions, exercises. Or?
Correct. So a lot of these vision disorders kind of present like dyslexia, which is another word that we're used to hearing. Mm-hmm. So when a child is reading, they'll tend to skip lines when they're reading and tend to reverse letters or put letters in the wrong order when they're writing. So the child can be brilliant and tell you everything that they saw or read, but they're not good at taking tests because they can't focus for that long. So that leads to a lot of children being misdiagnosed with ADHD.
So how do you properly diagnose what you're describing?
So there are tests that you can do in the classroom, and there's also what I call a school vision questionnaire. So if you notice a child that's very smart and bright and you're like, why aren't they getting good grades? You can start asking them questions about, are your eyes getting fatigued? Are you having a lot of double vision? Are you having headaches when you read for a long period of time? Or are you easily distracted when we do reading comprehension, stuff like that?
So is this a little bit or a lot out of the mainstream? Like, is the school nurse looking for this kind of thing, or this is all new to them?
It is all new to them. Actually, I am a member of Lions Club here, and we're doing pretty much all the vision screenings in Georgia right now. We've started out the school year. We're already up to about 400 vision screenings. So I'm teaching them how to diagnose these conditions, and I'm also reaching out to the school systems so that they can understand better about these children and these vision disabilities so that they're not being missed.
So when you first started approaching people about this in these sometimes bureaucratic systems, or maybe you're still finding this, I mean, did they initially, you know, where you've been all our lives, come on in, or were they a little, you know, little standoffish, a little skeptical?
I'm still in the middle of that. There's only three other vision therapy clinics in the whole state of Georgia, and kids are mandated to be screened for vision in the first grade, the third grade, the seventh grade, and I believe the 11th grade in Georgia. But every state isn't that stringent as Georgia is, but there's only certain tests that are mandatory. So the vision test for the binocular screening isn't mandatory, even though it does affect children's learning and their behavior.
So how is this a business? Or is it, I mean, is it a revenue producing?
So as an occupational therapist, most people that have children with learning disabilities or autism or ADHD are seeking physical therapy, occupational therapy, and speech therapy for their child. So as a part of this, we do different assessments for visual, perceptual, auditory processing, and other types of screenings and evaluations where we can find these disorders for children, and then the children will come to the clinic and get therapy for that.
So much of what you're saying really resonates with me on a personal level, and I'll share with you why. Reading, vision, sports, before people got bigger and had more work ethic than I did, all candidly came quite easy to me. Mm-hmm. My younger brother, 2 years younger than I am, I don't know if he had dyslexia. I don't know if he had what you had, but stuff like that came harder to him. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't like to talk about my brother much because he's younger, better looking, and makes more money. So I don't really – nah, he's a good guy. I just spent the weekend with him. But one of the things that came of that, I think he had to work harder all the way through. Now, my folks were educators, and maybe they were a little more proactive in getting whatever testing was available. And I can remember him like taking karate lessons to help with his balance and all this kind of stuff. So I've seen it, and I've seen him come through, and he really is incredibly successful and certainly very bright. But school didn't come as easy to him, and in the early years, sports didn't come as easy to him. So that's one of the things to at least kind of look out for, huh?
Correct. It does affect hand-eye coordination as well. So just the neurological pathways in the brain are kind of affected for these disorders.
But there are things like they did, and I guess it had some positive impact. There are things you can do to, what are you like rewiring? What's going on?
That's exactly what's going on. The brain has a lot of neuroplasticity. And if you catch it early, then it really helps these children. So
what can we do to help? What do you need more of right now?
So, with my daughter, who I told you has the vision disorders, we do a lot of eye gaze training. So, and we do eye patching, where you patch one eye and work on that eye, and then you patch the other eye and read something with that eye, and then you put the two eyes together and work on that. We also have different strategies and techniques. So using like a ruler or a book marker under each line when you're reading so you won't skip lines. Practicing things such as visual closure. So if you're drawing a circle or a star, the child has to complete one side and you complete the other side. Or things like where's Waldo, trying to find Waldo in the picture, or looking at two pictures and saying which one is different and which one is the same.
I remember that. My granddaddy used to get like this neighborhood paper, and the pictures really looked very much alike, and you had to pick out the differences. That was kind of hard, but that's a good exercise. Huh?
Correct.
All right, so what do you need, though? You need more awareness. You need more practitioners, more people in the school systems and other systems who are trying to serve our youth. You need them having these conversations?
Correct, exactly.
And is there formal education, informal education, other resources that we ought to be trying to get in their hands, or do we need to go back even more and fund and find a way to craft these resources?
Well, there are some books out there. One of my professors, Dr. Mary Warren, she was one of the founders of Vision Therapy and Low Vision Rehab. And there's Dr. Mitchell Scheinman. Him and his wife have wrote a lot of books about pediatric occupational therapy and vision disorders. He's actually an optometrist and his wife is an occupational therapist. So I've been to a lot of his courses and learned a lot from him.
All right. So I'm a young father and I've got a, you know, a 3-year-old. I don't know what time. I don't want to miss this. Right. And so what should I do? Should I get them in front of someone? Should I do some things at home? What are some, if I'm hearing this, what should I be doing?
So when a child is in their developmental stages, about 6 to 9 months, it really helps to have those cause and effect type of games. So if you push a button and something lights up,
right.
That really helps children with their developmental skills. And then do you remember the old game where you put the square in the open the square in the square, the circle.
We had a
circle.
Ball. Yes. We had a ball that we did that with.
Correct.
And then I don't know how you got the stuff back out of the ball. Maybe mom did that part, but I do remember there was a star and a square and a circle and a half moon. Yeah,
correct.
I remember that.
Those types of things help children. You think they're just toys, but they really are developmental games.
All right. So doing that is, it's not going to hurt anyone.
No.
And it might really help. Mm-hmm. Somebody, you got a take on this, Carlos?
I find it fascinating. I had a son. Our youngest son had some vision problems when he was really young, and given a 7-year-old, 8-year-old a $700 pair of glasses is you take a big gulp and like, oh, don't let anything happen. So I love hearing what you're doing.
Great, thank you.
So we need to do a better job of awareness. We need to get folks having these conversations. But I got to go back to the whole entrepreneur thing. I mean, it's one thing to be an advocate. Mm-hmm. It's one thing for one of your boxes with the right boundaries around it. Like mm-hmm. we discussed earlier, being you invest time, you know, during the week advocating for this thing and helping as best you can. It's a completely different thing to say, this is going to be my business. Help me understand the timeline on this. Were you already sort of in the field?
Yes. I worked with individuals with traumatic brain injury. I was in the Navy for a while. So I was stationed at Naval Medical Center, San Diego. So I did a lot with traumatic brain injury and, blast injuries and concussions. So we worked a lot of neurological rehab there. And, I actually had an optometrist take me under his wing while I was there. And he was big on these vision disorders. And he was big on occupational therapists actually addressing them. So he taught me a lot about that. And also, I started, after my daughter was diagnosed, I kind of started putting two and two together. I was like, this is the same stuff I already know how to do. So I started working with her at home. And I noticed that her reading Lexile score went up 400 points in 1 year. She was really struggling in the third grade.
I have no idea
reading.
What that is, but that sounds like an important thing.
So her reading comprehension increased tremendously. And every year, the children have to take a standardized test called the CRCT here in Georgia. And for the fifth grade year, they really, really ramp it up, amp it up so that they can see where the kids stand when they get to middle school. So this past year, my daughter as a fifth grader scored on the 9th grade level for reading and writing when she barely could pass a reading comprehension test in 3rd grade. So we've been working hard for the past 2 years.
Wow, that has got to be incredibly encouraging. So can we expect in the fairly near future the Normandy methodology, the Normandy vision pack that the school systems can buy or that we can, or you know what, nowadays, y'all can't see me on the radio, but I made this gesture like it was a pack of papers, but it could be on some sort of online thingy, right?
I absolutely plan on writing a book about this and making some handouts and getting them out to the school system.
So you have a book in you just to talk about all of these topics and then maybe some actual job aids. I don't know if that's the right word, but some actual things to people can use. And will you make some that the lay person can utilize with their kids?
Absolutely.
That would be important to me, like at home, right? A lay person being able to use I don't even know what it would be, a workbook, an exercise
correct.
Thing?
It will be more like a workbook, yes. And eventually it will be sold on Amazon as well.
So it's early days for you in all of this.
Correct.
But you ought to take a tremendous, you ought to have a great deal of hope listening to Carlos talk, right?
Yes.
About where he's been, maybe take some advice and cordon it off and don't let it consume you 24/7, 365. Yes. But so we're looking at dad books, resources, and increased awareness, and just continue to try to make an impact. So school system sounds like a no-brainer.
Yes, and parents with children with different developmental delays and disabilities.
All right, okay. Mm-hmm. So coming back, short horizon, mm-hmm. what's next for you? Where are you going to be putting your energy and effort next 6, 12 months?
Well, right now we have to get through all these vision screenings, and I have to train everyone that I'm doing the vision screenings with how to actually capture these diagnoses, these different disabilities with the vision. And then we'll be educating teachers and school nurses and counselors and principals and different people like that.
All right, so that's the early focus.
Yes.
So there's training these folks,
yes.
and if we take a page out of Carlos's philosophy, there's train the trainer.
Correct.
Right, so we can really replicate and leverage this thing.
Yes.
And then all the while, we know that we've got some things coming behind this in terms of resources. Is there also, maybe do you envision an advocacy element to this, to where maybe you try to influence legislatures to invest a little more time and at least exploring the idea of allocating more funds? Or
absolutely.
Or is that a problem? Maybe it's not
no,
a problem.
No, that's absolutely the goal long term. I'm a member of the National Small Business Association. Mm-hmm. So we write a lot of letters to the congressman. So
send them this interview too. So
yes,
look,
exactly.
I'm going everywhere. You got to help me.
But I definitely plan to try to help change for Georgia first, and then maybe the nation, and then also do a lot of medical mission trips. So they always need neurological peds in all these places. So I definitely feel like I should take it global as well.
Well, congratulations on the momentum that you're already achieving, and keep up the good work.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your story. All right, if someone wants to learn more mm-hmm. and they want to have a conversation with you or one of your certified trainers mm-hmm. or whomever in the near future, what's the best way for them to connect with you?
Okay, you can go to www.achievevisioncenter.com. Or you can email me at nricks@achieveoccupationaltherapysolutions.com.
Well, thank you so much for making the time to come in and share this with us. And I want to be here, and we want to be here to try to help you any way we can, get the word out and get some of these resources to where they belong.
Great. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, Blake, that was fun. That beats the heck out of work, and that's a good way to spend a Monday morning, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
All right. Until next time, this is Stone Payton for our guest today, our producer, Blake, and everyone here at the Business Radio X family saying we'll see you next time on Atlanta Business Radio.